Hey, I'm Troy Bronsink, and this is From the Hive, a contemplative space where meditative practice meets mindful everyday living. Our full episode has two parts, a conversation and a guided meditation. We're connecting you to a variety of contemplative teachers, hearing their story, as well as sharing a meditative practice. If you don't have time right now to hear the whole interview with Varun Soni, take a look at the show notes for where the meditation portion begins, and just feel free to skip ahead and come back later for the conversation. We've also learned from earlier episodes that it's challenging to move between the passive work of listening to an interview and the active work of sitting for a guided meditation. And since we're all about you getting a practice started, we will release what we call a pocket practice later on next week with just the meditation portion on its own. Today we're speaking with Dr. Varun Soni. He's the Dean of Religious Life at the University of Southern California. He's a Hindu that is the first Hindu to serve as a religious or spiritual leader in an American university in that kind of dean or chaplain or spiritual student formation space. He's also a speaker and a scholar of religions, does a number of things, including a book on mysticism, exploring the prophetic life of Bob Marley and Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. Also has done a bunch of different series with folks like the Dalai Lama and Ravi Shankar and Krista Tippett, Kobe Bryant, Sting. So it's bound to be a great conversation. You could be doing a million different things right now. Like maybe you're deciding to look for those old Ravi Shankar and Sting albums, or maybe you're folding some laundry or taking the dog for a walk. Whatever it is, take a moment to look around you. Take a couple deep breaths. Notice, are the seasons changing? Notice the temperature. And just enjoy listening in. Hopefully you'll be able to sit with us during the meditation portion in the second half. Well, Varun Soni, what a treat to have this time with you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a great privilege to join you this morning.
Yeah. There's a lot of different ways this conversation could go, both the intersection of your work as an artist, your experience internationally with a number of different faith expressions and where that intersects contemplative work, and then your work at the university. So I'd love to just kind of start with this place of like, tell us a little bit about how you ended up at USC and the work you do there.
Okay, sure, yes. So I am the Dean of Religious Life at the University of Southern California. It essentially means that I'm the university's chaplain. There are two different titles, but the work is very similar. And what that means is that I oversee religious and spiritual life at USC, which has more religious groups than any American university. We have almost 100 different student religious groups representing every faith tradition in the world. We have more campus chaplains than any American university. We have almost 60 chaplains representing many faith perspectives and denominations, including a humanist chaplain for agnostic, atheist, humanist students. And we reside right here in the heart of Los Angeles, the most religiously diverse city in the world. So the opportunities for religious reflection and spiritual inquiry, for interfaith work and community service are rich and endless, honestly.
Yeah.
We also have on our campus students from 120 different countries, from all 50 states, 11,000 international students. So it's really the world right here on our campus. And so we can do a lot of work, not just connecting people between faiths in an interfaith context, but also within faiths in an intra-faith context. Muslim students will meet other Muslim students from all over the Muslim world and walk away with, I think, a deeper appreciation for how rich and diverse that tradition is. Same thing with every religious group on campus. My own journey here, I think, is somewhat unusual. I'm the first Hindu in American history to be the chief religious or spiritual leader of a university. Wow. When I was hired in 2008, I was the only non-Christian in the country, and that was the case for the last 8 or 9 years. And at a time when every other dean of religious life or university chaplain in the United States was an ordained Protestant minister, USC hired me, a non-ordained Hindu attorney. I credit Obama for that. This was 2008. Like, campaign was in full swing. He just got the nomination when I was a candidate. There was a lot of hope and change in the air. I was a kid with the funny name at the right time. So I give a lot of credit to Obama for that. But, USC really thought outside the box, and I was the lucky sort of beneficiary of that kind of thinking. And over the last 10 years, my goal has really been to think about how we can build an office of religious life for the future, not how we replicate the past. How do we honor, acknowledge, and support our students' changing religiosity, their own changing self-identities in terms of spiritual formation? How do we recognize that our university campus is a campus where 45% of our incoming students are not affiliated with religion, and 65% say they're more spiritual than religious? Wow. One of the things we did with our office is to make sure that we weren't oriented around God, and that's unusual for an office of religious life, for a chaplain's office. Instead, we're oriented around meaning and purpose and significance and authenticity and identity and the things that make us human. Because I have a campus of 45,000 students, 15,000 staff, and 5,000 faculty. So my congregation is 65,000. It's a mid-sized American city.
Yeah.
And the one thing that connects all those people from all those different perspectives and identities, experiences, regions, and traditions is that as humans, we're deeply invested in meaning-making and the quest for purpose in our lives, the quest for community, and a sense of being part of something bigger than ourselves, regardless of whether we're theistic or not. So my hope is that by orienting our office around life's big questions, the ultimate existential questions of meaning and purpose, the questions that make us human, we can be a resource for our entire university community, not just those who self-identify as theistic. But meanwhile, for those who are theistic, I think we have more as many resources and opportunities as any school. We just want to have a fully expansive and inclusive conversation when we're talking about spiritual life.
Yeah, I love the way you frame that around being human. And sometimes with the Hive, we struggle with that sense of like somebody asking, is this a faith community? And it's like, well, it's a spiritual formation space, and people bring their faiths to bear in that work. And our own lineages and faith expressions come to life there. How do you describe spiritual formation in like to the kind of incoming student at USC? Would they, in a way that they'd recognize themselves in that practice? Because sometimes even that language of spiritual formation sounds a little woo-woo.
Yeah.
Say a little more about that.
Yeah, well, the good news is, as Dean of Religious Life, I can be a little woo-woo. I take that. If anyone can do it, I have, I think, the mandate to be able to do that. But I think you're right. A lot of students say, I'm spiritual but not religious, and that's where the conversation ends. But my goal is to challenge them to really articulate what that means, and not just to say it, but to live it and breathe it in some way or another. I always ask students, what's the difference between spirituality and religion? And I hear a lot of different comments. My favorite was an Indian engineering student who told me that religion was closed sourced, but spirituality was open sourced. I think that essentially, you know, what I try and do with religion, in terms of challenging students to think about their own spiritual life, is to challenge them to think about the questions, not the answers. The reason they're at a research university like USC, one of the most selective universities in the world, is because they've had the right answers to the questions in their life. They've done well on the tests. They've done well on the standardized exams. They've done well in terms of their personal statements and their applications. They've had all the right answers. But I think spirituality really challenges us to struggle with and live through the big questions in our life of meaning and purpose, and who are we, and what matters to us, and why does it matter to us? I think that in American higher education, because it's gotten so expensive, you know, USC this year is not the most expensive school in the country, but room and board for a first-year student is $72,000. Because it's gotten expensive, and because industries are shifting so dramatically, USC has the best journalism school in the world, but like, what does it mean to be a journalist in this day and age? The whole industry has been disrupted. Mm-hmm. Because of those trends, I think students really look at a university now as a pre-professional opportunity, as almost a transactional opportunity to get certified to go into a particular career. But traditionally, the liberal arts has been about asking the questions of meaning and purpose. It's been about thinking about who you are and what is your role in the world. And so in asking those questions, I believe that students are not only connecting with their own spiritual lives, but also with what is a traditional liberal arts education, critical, rigorous thinking about what it means to be a global citizen and what our ethics and responsibility are in this world. I really focus on the questions, and I would say, you know, Deepak Chopra says, Religion is someone else's experiences. Spirituality is your own experience. Religion is the experience of the prophets, the priests, the pundits, the imams, the writers of sacred texts, the messiahs, the avatars. But spirituality is your own experience of moving and acting in the world. And so I also, you know, try and ask students to claim their experience in the world and to honor that experience in some way or another while they struggle with and wrestle with the big questions of meaning and purpose. So I guess that's, in some ways, what I'm trying to do runs counter to many, to the type of conditioning that brings a student to a university, always looking for the right answer. But I really want to challenge them to think about the right questions. Our students are always looking to succeed. I really want to challenge them to fail in a meaningful way, fail forward. Our students are always looking for sort of external markers of success, grades, status, internship, salary. I'm challenging them to think about the internal metrics of success, bravery, courage, contemplation, relationships, et cetera. So in some ways, I'm swimming upstream. But I also, I wouldn't do this work if I didn't really believe that the ages of 18 to 26 were the richest, most important ages in one's life to struggle with and think about these questions. And the kinds of thoughts and answers that students might get while asking these questions in college will in some ways shape the trajectory of the rest of their life. When I reflect upon my own college experience, that was the sort of most important part, the struggling with the big questions. And that's what I want for my students too.
That's awesome. I'm listening to a David White book right now where he's talking about Lewis Carroll and this ability to keep that youthful drug that allows us to take that risk. There's a window to it, and when you can continue to nourish it or we can squelch it. And he sees it as this kind of like light. He just tells some great stories about it. So it gets me thinking with, tell us a little bit more about you and maybe at this moment, what is the meaning that's changing for you? What are the questions that are, that have really got your attention right now?
Well, my own life, these are the questions that have defined my life in some way or another. It wasn't always apparent to me, but when I reverse engineer my narrative, I begin to see sort of how one seed was planted that led to another sort of that led to something blossoming, that led to something that led to something that led to this.
Sure, sure.
So I start to see the causal chain in my own story in a way that wasn't always apparent to me as I was living it. But as an immigrant to the United States, I'm the child of immigrants. I am an immigrant. I moved to the United States at a very young age from India. I'm really the child of the 1965 Immigration and Naturalization Act. So between the mid 20s and the mid 60s, Asians basically were excluded from immigrating and naturalizing as citizens to the United States. And the 1965 Immigration and Naturalization Act opened up a small window for professionals from Asian countries. My family's from India. To come to the United States. So my parents were physicians. They were able to immigrate to the United States. Everyone in my community were physicians and engineers because that's how they could come here. So we were raised in an environment that we were really the first Hindu Americans, the first ethnic Hindus to be raised in the United States. And so we didn't really know what it meant to be Indian, but we knew that, we weren't quite American. I think my generation felt neither here nor there. We didn't have public sort of role models. We had Apu from The Simpsons. That was about it. It was a confusing time, I think, for Hindu Americans, for me as an Indian American, as an immigrant, et cetera. When I was young, my grandparents moved in with me, and my grandfather was my grandfather's mother, so my great-grandmother, was very close friends with Kasturba Gandhi, who's Mahatma Gandhi's wife. And my great-grandmother was one of the leaders of the women's movement within the Indian National Congress. And so my grandfather grew up around Gandhi and Nehru. He would sit on their laps. He would listen to them speak. And he raised me with those stories. And when I was like 9 or 10, the movie Gandhi came out. And for the first time, we saw our story on a big screen in a way that really made me proud, not just of being Indian, but of my family's connection with Gandhi. And so I think at a young age, I started asking these questions about spirituality and social justice through the prism of Gandhi as a way of trying to figure out who I was as an Indian American or a Hindu American. And being raised in a family of physicians, we were raised to be American. We were raised in a secular context. We were raised by scientists, right? And so when I went to college, I started to take classes in Asian studies, in Indian religion and politics and culture, just to learn about myself, just as a heritage student, just to see, you know, what my own lineage was. And in that process, I spent a semester in India, in Bodh Gaya, the town of the Buddha's enlightenment. I lived in a monastery. I met the Dalai Lama for the first time, who has been my sort of guru or my teacher for the last 25 years. And I, you know, I just, my mind was blown, and it put me on a very different path where the questions I was asking myself about my own identity became personal and professional questions that have really shaped my life. So the irony is that I came to my own Indian heritage and spiritual history through a Western research university. And now I have the opportunity to connect students with their own traditions and the traditions of others in a very similar way. So I do see this process as coming full circle. And, you know, like, I met the Dalai Lama when I was in college, and recently I hosted him at USC, and I introduced him to my students. And once again, I felt like the circle was coming around. I had in college, in some ways, I could reproduce for my students in a different time and place, but in a way that is hopefully transformative. So, you know, I'm an unusual person to inherit this job in terms of my background, but then when I got the job, everything I had done sort of felt like it made sense within the context of this work. And a lot of university chaplains feel that way too, that they never anticipated they would be in this role, but once they got it, they said, oh yeah, that's the role I always wanted, I just couldn't articulate it. Especially, I think, in terms of reconciling one's spiritual and scholarly identities. As a scholar of religion, you're taught to think critically about traditions. As a faith-based practitioner, you have an emotional relationship with traditions. Scholars of religion are often critiqued by practitioners as sort of missing the point. Practitioners are often critiqued by scholars as sort of having blind faith. To hold both roles as scholar-practitioner is very difficult. But as dean of religious life, my mandate is to bring together the spiritual and scholarly resources of the university. The dean aspect of my job is a scholarly designation, whereas the religious life aspect is a spiritual designation. So this thing I had also struggled with, reconciling who I was as a scholar versus a practitioner, in this position, I don't have to do that. You know, that feels empowering.
Yeah, it sounds very empowering. How do you, so that tension between the scholar and the practitioner, how does that play out in, like, what does practice look like for you in your day-to-day?
Well, in some ways, my scholarship is my spiritual practice. I feel like my teaching is my spiritual discipline. In the Hindu tradition, there's four paths to knowing God: the path of action, the path of devotion, the path of meditation or contemplation, and the path of knowledge. And the path of knowledge is a path of scriptural study, of debate, of reflection, of critical analysis, of teaching and learning. And throughout Hindu and Buddhist history, there are traditions where, you know, the teacher, the guru, like the Dalai Lama, is actually an academic. The Dalai Lama is a Geshe. He has what is the equivalent of a Tibetan Buddhist philosophy PhD within his own tradition. In some ways, I look at my spiritual practice as my academic work. But in my role as chaplain, you know, what I've learned from Buddhist philosophy, what I've learned from Buddhist psychology, what I've learned even from Buddhist practice, the importance of listening, the importance of empathy, the importance of being in the moment, those are the most important tools I have as a chaplain. You know, as a lawyer, when I came to this job and I had students in my office for pastoral care and spiritual counseling, I was always looking for a remedy, because as a lawyer, you're trained to think about remedies. And so when a student had a problem, I would come up with 1,000 ways that we could address it or fix it or whatever. But over time, and, you know, I hang out with other chaplains, I realized that as a chaplain, my job really is to be there to listen, to honor a student's pain and experience. It's not always to find the remedy. And in fact, the being there and the listening can be the remedy. So I think that the philosophical or academic study of Buddhism, especially in how it applies to the way we think about time, the present moment, the way we think about interconnection in terms of compassion and empathy, have been the greatest tools I've had as a chaplain. And that's an example of what I've studied academically translating into what I do pastorally.
That's awesome. So that space of, instead of fixing but being there,
Yeah.
That thread runs through a lot of the conversations I've noticed that we've had in these interviews or or at the Hive, some of the way the classes go. I'd love for you to explore that just a little more with us. So for a listener coming from any number of traditions that you've mentioned today, what would be a way of helping think through even just those three pieces of time and connection and empathy? What are ways to get that you use with folks to help them get into that space of being present?
When I was studying Buddhism in Nepal, a Tibetan Rinpoche said to me, "This conversation is the most important conversation in your life. This relationship is the most important relationship in your life. This moment is the most important moment of your life." And he said that within the context of our conversation, meaning that in every given moment, that the conversation you're having, the person you're having that conversation with, and the moment in which you're speaking are the most important moments, conversations, and relationships of your life. And that's what I try to use to guide me in the context of pastoral care, that I want to be there for my students with my full presence uninterrupted in that moment with their pain. And when I think about what my students are going through, I try to think about what I went through in college. And I'm constantly reliving my college years because I had students, I had friends who died in college. So when I'm consoling a student, I can sort of put myself in that position and think about what it's like to lose someone. I had, sort of volatile romantic relationships. So when a student is breaking up, I know what that must feel like for that student. I had friends who struggled with substance abuse. I had friends who were sexually assaulted. I had friends who were victimized because of their race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender identity in college. When I have those conversations with students, I try to put myself in that position based on my own experiences. So I think that in the being there, one can be empathetic by being human and thinking about what it was like for you in a similar situation. But one also, I think, needs to be there in the moment. The one thing I will say here is I work with a specific population, mostly undergraduate students, in pastoral care. Mm-hmm. The last 3 or 4 years, I've had a question every week that I never had in my career. And that question is, how do I make friends? And I think the reason we have that question is now we're moving out of millennials into the so-called post-millennials, Gen Z, iGen, whatever you want to call this next generation. And these are kids whose entire life has been defined by online social relationships. They never migrated to the platform. They were born into it. And what I found is that our students, even though they may have 1,000 friends online, when they get to a campus like ours, they really struggle with loneliness and alienation in a way that I have never seen before. They can talk with their thumbs, not so much with their tongues. And so I think in that context, where students are already feeling disconnected and lonely, they already are craving a human interaction. They're craving someone who can affirm their being here on this campus, their decisions they made that brought them here. In that context, being a chaplain, being present, being there, honoring what a student's going for is even more important, because what they're really craving is human connection. And I think we're going to start seeing more of that. And we don't even know what that means yet, because humans have communicated with each other in a certain way for thousands of years. And with this generation, now we're communicating in dramatically different ways. And that's a lot for any generation to carry.
That's wild. Yeah. That sense of isolation that happens in spiritual identity, sometimes there's a leap into there's an us and them that can alleviate an isolation, but it creates a new one, right? And then that the personal journey that folks are feeling, that even like it's hard to even know, how do I reach into a place of mutuality with another person? What does that vulnerability look like? And that takes a lot of courage.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm curious about, in reading some about your work, there's a regular use of the word mystic, I'm wondering if that even applies to what we're talking about right now. Is there a way that the mystic is listening for or participating in the present that, you know, in one sense looks like foolishness to the scholar, but also can look like foolishness to the practitioner, right? Like because it doesn't always seem practical. My curiosity is that there's a book you did with on Marley's work and Fatah Khan. Yeah. Huh?
Yeah.
And so I'm just curious what, if you'd share a little bit about, not necessarily, I mean, you could share some about that book, that'd be really interesting to hear, but then how does that play out in the day-to-day with a student's life, an awareness of mystery?
That's great. I think it's really an astute observation. The mystic is critiqued by the scholar because the mystic doesn't articulate a philosophical or theological position in the same way that a scholar would recognize. And the mystic is critiqued often by the more mainstream practitioners because the mystic transgresses social norms and sort of ritualized context, which the practitioner, you know, believes is normative. So you're right. The mystic stands alone in that regard. One of my mentors told me in college something that stuck with me, and that is, you can doubt a creed, but you can't doubt a dance. You can doubt a creed, but you can't doubt a dance.
Come on.
We can argue about any creed. We can argue about any position. We can argue about any belief. But once there's a dance, you can't really argue about the dance. You may enjoy it or may not enjoy it, but you can't sort of critique that it's a dance. And so that, to me, stuck with me because I think that gets us to the role of the non-dual. How do we move beyond dualism? If ultimately the ineffable experience or the transcendent experience of the universe or of God or of oneself I think most traditions would say that experience is actually beyond words. Once you start using words to describe the ultimate reality, you limit that ultimate reality. Words are inherently dualistic. Words break up the world into constituent parts, but the real experience, the mystic's experience, is beyond all that duality, beyond those constituent parts. So I think where mysticism might intersect with university life is in the arts. USC has the best arts constellation of schools in the country, the best film school. We have music, architecture, dance, fine arts, dramatic arts. So I have a lot of students who are fully invested in the arts. And in the arts, I think that they can start to find that space where they're going beyond words. Like, that's why poetry is so important. Poetry uses words to get beyond words, uses words to describe what you can't describe, to get beyond the intellectual mind into the feeling or thought of the internal world that all of us carry with us. And so I often challenge my students to find that space beyond words and whatever they're doing. If they're an athlete, what does it mean to be in the zone? If they're an artist, how do they express that which can't be expressed? And if they're students, I think that's where mindfulness comes in. How do you move into a space where mentally you're not clinging to particular words? How do you find that moment of peace between your thoughts? And so I think there are ways for all of us to cultivate that in our life, but that sort of ecstatic embrace of the non-dual that that characterizes much of mysticism, I think we find that in the arts. And I see our students in many ways using the arts, not at least in college, not to create commercial products, mm-hmm. but to think about the big questions in their life. And that's really cool to see.
That's awesome. You mentioned these moments of peace. What would it look like in an average kind of rhythm of your week where you end up finding peace?
Well,
because it sounds like you're juggling a lot of plates, right?
Yeah. You know, the irony is that I'm running the largest mindfulness initiative probably in American higher education. We've trained 5,000 people in mindfulness practice in the last 4 years and 5 to 8 week courses, but I find it hard as the chief evangelist of mindfulness to carve out mindful time in my day. Obviously that, is something I recognize. I do think all of us have to engage in sort of self-care in a way that makes sense for us. And for me, there are things that aren't negotiable in my week. Like, I live on the beach, and, you know, at least once a week I'll go for a long ride. That to me is part of my mindfulness practice. That's mm-hmm. where I have my most clear-headed moments. And I feel away from the stresses of my daily life. So I think we all have to figure out how to do that. One of the things I do is, within the context of pastoral care, oftentimes I'll teach students quick mindfulness activities to decrease stress. And I do it for my students' benefit, but I also do it for my benefit.
I hear you there. Yeah.
It almost gives me permission to take 5 minutes to be mindful or to meditate my own day. But, you know, the reason why I am such a proponent of mindfulness in higher education is because when I was in college and I lived in a monastery and I learned how to meditate, I brought that back with me and I taught my friends, and I saw how, even in a secular context, just simple breathing exercise helped them deal with the stress and anxiety of finals or of, graduation or whatever they were going through. In the 20 years since I've been in college, what's changed is the research. 20 years ago, it was a Buddhist practice, 20 years ago, Jon Kabat-Zinn put out the first peer-reviewed paper on mindfulness. 20 years later, it's a secular practice. And last year alone, there were 600 peer-reviewed articles on mindfulness, studies that are funded by NIH and other foundations. So over the last 20 years, the research has caught up with, the science has caught up with spirituality, and we're able to position mindfulness as a secular intervention for wellness and work productivity in learning outcomes in a way that we couldn't have done 20 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this has been an awesome conversation, and I really appreciate your generosity of time and just to hear the number of ways you have integrated this notion that presence has value across a variety of faiths and ethnicities and experiences, and to bring them together with the youthful experience of a university campus. It's really inspiring. So,
and thank you. I'm so grateful for the work that you do. One of the benefits of my sort of work in mindfulness is to learn about how mindfulness manifests in so many different aspects of American life. And the work that you do is so important. The community that you're building is so profound. I'm just really grateful that you're doing this work. So thank you.
Oh, thanks, Varun Soni. We're going to come back in a minute and have you guide us in a practice. Set us up here for this practice from your tradition.
Great. So, you know, I'm Hindu, born and raised. I identify as Hindu, but I've been very influenced by Buddhism. I lived in a Buddhist monastery. My teacher, the Dalai Lama, is a Buddhist teacher. And in studying Hinduism and Buddhism, I began to realize that sort of the boundaries that we draw around the traditions are in many ways artificial, manufactured, and in some ways a result of colonial scholarship. But the reality is that these traditions have been in conversation with each other throughout their existence, and they share many of the same beliefs around contemplative practice. Within the Hindu worldview, the idea is that we all have a soul, and that soul is a reflection of a bigger soul. So you could say that we all have a soul, and that soul is a reflection of God, and so our souls are divine. That means we're inherently divine. That's why the Hindu greeting of Namaste literally means the divinity within you acknowledges and salutes, or the divinity within me acknowledges and salutes the divinity within you. The recognition that what is animating both of us is emanating from the same source. So the idea is that we are born through multiple lifetimes. Hinduism and Buddhism don't believe in linear time like the Abrahamic traditions. They believe in cyclical time. So we're born in through multiple lifetimes, multiple incarnations, with the goal that the soul will be released from the cycle of rebirth, therefore released from the cycle of suffering, and become one with the universal soul or cosmic consciousness or God, whatever you want to call it. And so that's the idea. So that means that within us, we already have the tools for our own liberation. And the Buddhists would say, you're already an enlightened Buddha, you just have to recognize it. The Hindus would say, you're already God, you just have to recognize it. How do we do that? Well, with the Hindu tradition, the idea is that there's two levels of consciousness. There's the gross level of consciousness. That's the world of name and form. That's the world that we experience. And that's the world that we filter through our own ego, where we project our identity to the external world. We may crave things. We may be attached to things. But it's being filtered through our own ego, our own emotions, it's being filtered through the little soul, our personal soul. But there's also a subtle level of consciousness, a deeper level of consciousness that's below the gross level of consciousness. And that consciousness is divine consciousness or the big soul, universal consciousness. Just like the waves may be violent on top, below the waves, it's calm, the very bottom. And that calmness is our divine consciousness, according to many Hindu beliefs and schools of thought. So how do we then bridge the gap between these levels of consciousness? That is where meditation comes in. It creates a bridge that connects the gross to the subtle, that connects the personal to divine, that connects what is filtered through the ego to what is beyond ego. And that's where mantras come in. Mantra in Sanskrit, man is the Sanskrit word for mind. Tra is a suffix that literally means an instrument of stretching. So a mantra is an instrument to stretch one's mind. In many ways, it's a spiritual technology. We think of technology as coming out of a scientific process that's been hypothesized and tested over time. So too are mantras. Mantras are thousands of years old, and they're based on the idea of vibration, that if you recite certain sounds or syllables, it'll resonate with certain areas within you, your chakras, your power centers, that will open your consciousness up to a divine realization. That's what transcendental meditation is kind of based on, this idea of mantra meditation.
Oh, so sure. So the so we're going to take a break now, and we'll come back in and invite you to kind of walk us through that process. Thanks so much.
Hey there, you've been listening to From the Hive, a contemplative space where meditative practice meets up with mindful everyday living. I'm your host, Troy Bronsink, founder and director of The Hive, a center for contemplation, art, and action. We're a nonprofit located in the North Side neighborhood of Cincinnati, and for 2 years now, we're celebrating our second anniversary. We've been getting folks together into courses and small groups to develop your deeper practices as well as connect that to action and creativity in the world. If you take a look at our website, cincyhive.org, and check out classes, a number of them, actually about 15 or so, will be coming out in May, including classes around engaged Buddhism, Christian contemplative practices, art journaling, and second half of life, and many more. So you should check them out. And we also just began a new podcast called The Common Good, where we've been having conversations with Walter Brueggemann, Peter Block, and John McKnight at the intersection of belonging and place and remembering. So you should check that out as well. All right, let's return now to Varun Soni as he's teaching us the So Hum mantra.
A very simple mantra that I'd like to start with is a mantra that many kids are given, many Hindu kids are given in India. And it's the mantra of So Hum. So Hum is kind of means I am. I am. But it, you know, the meaning isn't as important as the sound or the vibration. And so what would a So Hum meditation look like? Yeah, it's very simple. You would just sit down in a comfortable position. Doesn't have to be cross-legged. Doesn't have to be on the floor. It could just be in a chair. And with your and you would breathe deeply in and out of your nose. With the in-break breath of your nose, you would focus on So. So as you're breathing in through the nostril, in your mind's eye, you're reciting So. And as you're breathing out, you recite Hum. And as your mind wanders, you slowly bring it back to So Hum. It's a point of concentration for the meditation. Your mind will wander. We know that. That's what happens. It's important not to judge that, not to label that, not to give it too much power. Just watch your thoughts and bring it back to So Hum. Your mind is like the sky, and your thoughts are like clouds that pass by. You can watch it pass by. Don't be attached, but bring it back to So Hum. And eventually, what you might find is that as you continue to focus on So Hum, the gross level of consciousness slowly subsides. You start to think less about your day-to-day activities, less about what someone might be thinking of you, less about all the things you haven't done, less about yourself. You begin to reside within a place that is beyond words, in a place that is more subtle. It's like the moment before you sneeze. You have a moment where you're not thinking anything. You almost have a clear-headedness. That's the gross level of consciousness. And And that's where you want to kind of reside for as long as you can with a Soham meditation. And if you're there, you might not need Soham. At some point, the mantra is just a way to get you there. And if that's where you're residing, you can slowly let the mantra go too. It's like the Buddha said with the life boat. The boat takes you to the other shore, but when you get to the other shore, you don't need to carry the boat with you. It served its purpose. In some ways, the mantra is the vehicle to get you to that other shore.
All right. Well, let's start that now. We have Keaton Neely here with us, who will be laying down some kind of atonal drum track, and just invite the listeners to join us for a moment in this practice. So sit there where you are, kind of breathing in, so, breathing out.
slowly begin to turn back to the room. Thank you for practicing with us, and thank you, Varun, for this discussion and for opening us up to this practice and to your story.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You bet. Varun Soni, it's been a pleasure, and we'll put some things in the show notes as ways for folks to kind of follow up with the other work you're doing, and wish you a great day.
Thanks for listening. I'm Troy Bronsink, and this has been From the Hive, a contemplative space where meditative practice meets mindful everyday living. We've been talking with Varun Soni. You can check out the show notes for ways to connect to his work and be on the lookout for a pocket practice, a shorter version, later this week. From the Hive is produced by Joey Taylor. Take a deep breath and enjoy your day.